Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one and record your name as prompted. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn today's meeting over to Brady Phillips. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, operator. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining our call today. Again, my name is Brady Phillips, and I'm a public affairs specialist at NOAA's Office of Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. So today we'll highlight key features from the State of the Climate in 2015 report that was just released today as a special edition of the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. This annual report provides a comprehensive peer-reviewed update on global climate indicators. First, a logistical note. Our speakers will reference specific slides from a PowerPoint presentation that can be downloaded at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/BREFINGS. And if you go to that site, you basically have to press the August 18th date. That's just a remnant of other presentation that we normally put up on the third Thursday of the month. But if you go to the August 18th date, you should be able to download the PowerPoint presentation. So today we'll have four short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. And during the presentations, all participants will be muted. Our first speaker will be Tom Carl, the director of NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information and chair of the Subcommittee on Global Change Research. The second presenter is Jessica Blunden, a climate scientist, also at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information and co-editor of the report. A third presenter will be Gregory Johnson, an oceanographer at NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory and the lead editor of the Oceans chapter. And the final presenter will be Jackie Richter-Menge, the Arctic chapter editor and a research civil engineer at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory. So in addition, on standby, we do have Dee Gart, the chief of the monitoring branch at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, also one of the co-editors of the report, available to answer questions during the Q&A. So we'll begin with Tom Carl. Tom?
Thanks, Brady. Really appreciate that. For those of you who actually get a copy of the special supplement to the bulletin, or those of you get a copy of the online presentation, there is a cover front and back that looks fairly interesting. It's actually artwork by Jill Pelto, whose arts appeared in the Smithsonian Institution. She's an artist, but also has a Master in Science in the University of Maine. We'll point this out because if you actually look at the art is composed of time series of actual global observations, changes in global temperature, sea level, and other important variables and indicators. So I thought that would be an interesting aside if you happen to get copies of the actual report. Again, this is the 26th year of the publication State of the Climate. It's actually essential information. It's essential from the standpoint we have to understand how the planet is changing and varying in terms of its climate and related indicators in order to understand where we may be going into the future. This publication has evolved enormously over the past 26 years. It has become an international activity. Last year, we had 413 authors from 58 countries. This year, we have 456 authors from 62 countries. It really does take a concerted effort. Our two editors, Jessica Blunden and Deke Arndt, organized this with all these additional contributors. It is a key publication so we can understand how we compare each year to what we've seen in the past for a whole variety of essential climate variables and related indicators. One thing this report does not do, we will not be talking about the causes of the events that we see. This information is about documenting the changes and observations we've seen. There will be a follow-up report in October of this year that focuses more specifically on the causes of extreme events from around the world, so stand by for that. One thing that you'll see on the slide number three, if you're looking at the slides, is the distribution of nations contributing to this report, authors from these various nations, and you can see, indeed, it is a global contribution. We actually had 16 editors this year to help Jessica and Deke. They span three continents. We focus on information in the atmosphere, on the land, in the ocean, snow and ice. And this year, for the first time, we've gone into additional detail on changes in ecosystems. There's a number of sidebars in the publication. You'll be hearing a little bit about that from our speakers. So with that introduction, I'd like to turn it over to Jessica Blunden.
Great. Thank you, Tom. In the next couple of slides, we're going to look at two of the major factors that influence the Earth climate system, and then we're going to look at some of the conditions from 2015. So if you turn to slide four, we're going to focus on greenhouse gases. The three major greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, all reached new record highs in 2015, as they do every year for the past many years. At Mauna Loa, Hawaii, which is the station that has the world's longest continuous measurement of carbon dioxide, the annual average concentration surpassed 400 parts per million for the first time, and this was 85% parts per million greater than when measurements first began there back in 1958. So over 66 years, carbon dioxide increased by 85 parts per million at this station. And looking at the annual global carbon dioxide concentration for 2015, it was just shy of that. It was 399.4 parts per million, which means that 2016 is going to easily surpass this milestone. The average increase over carbon dioxide has risen over the past half century from around 0.6 parts per million per year in the early 1960s to around 2.1 parts per million per year just over the last 10 years. Moving on to the next slide, we're going to focus on climate variability and look at the El Nino. One of the strongest El Nino events since at least 1950 developed in spring 2015 and continued to evolve throughout the year. This phenomenon, which is part of the El Nino Southern Oscillation, is measured by warming temperatures across the eastern and central Pacific Ocean. And we can see the surface temperature, the sea surface temperature, increase in the bottom right graphic. Temperatures above the red line, that's at 0.5 degrees Celsius, indicate that El Nino conditions are present. And we can see the increase in temperature through the year, meaning that the El Nino is continuing to get stronger. El Nino impacted regions across the globe and affected most aspects of the climate system, as we'll talk about. Moving on to the next slide, number six, we're going to look at global temperature. So aided by both the long-term warming trend due to the increasing greenhouse concentration, gas concentrations we talked about, and to the strong El Nino, the 2015 global temperature across land and ocean surfaces exceeded the previous record that was set just 1 year before in 2014 by a margin of about 0.13 to 0.18 degrees Celsius, depending on which data set you look at. We have four independent major data sets that show the change over time. They all indicate record high in 2015. This was the highest margin to break a temperature record since 1998, broke the record for 1997. This was also when a strong El Nino was in place. And this was also the first time the global average surface temperature was more than 1 degree Celsius higher than the average of the mid to late 19th century. And that's a time, of course, that's generally considered to be representative of pre-industrial conditions. So 2015 was 1 degree Celsius higher in pre-industrial conditions. In 2015, the warmth was spread across the globe. At least a dozen countries, including geographically large countries of China and Russia, reported record warmth nationally. And the only land areas with temperatures below average were parts of southern South America, eastern Canada, Greenland, and Antarctica. Moving on to the next slide, number seven, we're going to look at an indicator called warm days. This is a relatively new global indicator that we've added to our report recently because while it's a really big deal that the global temperature was record high for 2015, that doesn't necessarily mean that much to us personally. And that's because we don't actually experience what the global average temperature is. What we experience are our local temperatures, and we're affected by the daily temperature extremes where we live, and so that's why we've added this new indicator. And 2015 did bring a lot of extreme temperature events to regions around the world. Most of the events were on the warm side as opposed to the cool side, as you can see by the graphic where red indicates a high number of warm days compared to the average. Overall, globally, 2015 had close to twice the number of warm days. That's the number of days with temperatures in the highest 10th percentile of measurements compared to the 1961 to 1990 average. So just to give you a couple of examples where we saw this warmth, this was highlighted in our report. In June, one of the most severe heat waves in more than three decades affected Karachi, Pakistan. This event claimed over 1,000 lives. Another example, from late June to early September 2015, much of Europe was under the influence of a super strong and long-lasting heat wave. High nighttime temperatures were reported here. With high nighttime temperatures in particular, this can affect human health because our bodies don't really get a chance to cool off from the daytime heat. As noted in the report, in Belgium and in Netherlands, there was indeed a sharp increase in fatalities during this heat wave period. Moving on to the next slide, number 8, we're going to turn our attention to drought. This is also another relatively new indicator, for a global indicator that we've added to our report. In this graphic, the brown indicates drought conditions, extreme drought, and the blue indicates moisture. So we're focusing on the brown here. Preliminary data indicate that about 30% of the world's land surfaces were impacted by some form of drought during 2015, and that's among the largest areas since at least 1950. 14% of the area was impacted actually by severe or extreme drought. Those are the two most dire categories. And that compares with 8% in 2014. The expansion of drought over the year is consistent with less moisture that moves from the oceans to the land during El Niños, so we do expect to see more drought during El Niño years, and indeed we did. Drought can impact water supplies, hydroelectric power, agricultural production, and therefore food security or insecurity, affecting people who live in these regions and well beyond those regions. Among the areas hit hard by drought in 2015 were Southern Africa, Australia, parts of Southeast Asia, Central America, the Caribbean, the Amazon region of South America, Eastern Europe, Western Russia, and the Western United States. So, drought conditions and their impact were widespread, impacting tens of millions of people in 2015. If we move on to the next slide, we're going to change gears a little bit and look at tropical cyclones. In 2015, there were 101 tropical cyclones across all the ocean basins. That's 25% higher than the 1981 to 2010 average of 82. 36 of these storms reached major hurricane intensity. That's about 70% higher than the average of 21. So we not only had more storms, but we also had more intense storms. And this may have been enhanced because of the El Niño. It probably was. But this is also what we expect to see in a warming world. The eastern central Pacific Ocean, where we monitor El Niño conditions, this particular basin had 26 storms. That's the most there since 1992. Many of these storms were strong. The figure on this slide shows three simultaneous Category 4 hurricanes lined up next to each other on August 30th of last year. That's the first time this type of event has happened in any basin since at least 1950. In other areas across the globe, the western North Pacific and North and South Indian Ocean basins also saw high tropical cyclone activity. And on the flip side, and consistent also with El Niño patterns, the North Atlantic season was relatively quiet in 2015. And now I'm going to turn the presentation over to Greg, who's going to discuss conditions in the oceans.
Hi. So I'm going to start out by talking, if you look at slide 10, about some of the things we saw in the ocean related to 2015's strong El Nino. So if we look at the upper left slide, that is east-west surface current anomalies in 2015 relative to a long-term average. And you see I've circled in red, in black, this area of strong eastward surface currents along the tropical Pacific. And this was actually the second year in a row like this. 2014 looked kind of like an El Nino in the ocean, but it did not in the atmosphere, and so it was not an El Nino. But what is that? What do those currents do? What significance do they have? Well, if you look at the bottom right slide bottom right figure on slide 10, you'll see this is sea level change between 2015 and 2014. And so blue is falling sea level and red is rising sea level. And you can see sea level falling east of the Philippines from 2014 to 2015. And this was actually the second year in the row that happened. And sea level had been rising at a faster rate than the global average for the past couple decades. So this was probably a welcome relief to them. Conversely, in the eastern tropical Pacific, you can see sea level rising, and that's that red patch that circled, and off the west coast of North America. And these are both signs of an El Nino, and it's basically what's happening is these eastward surface currents are draining a pool of warm water in the western Pacific and carrying it east to the eastern Pacific. And as water warms, it expands, and so sea level rises. All right, if we go on to slide 11, I'm going to talk a little bit more about this because it doesn't just affect sea level, it actually also affects global heat. So if we look at the upper left panel, that shows La Nina conditions. It's a schematic and of the tropical Pacific. And the black arrows down near the ocean surface are the trade winds blowing from east to west, and they blow fairly strong during a La Nina. And they pile up warm water in the west, and the warm water is symbolized here by the red colors, and they bring cold water to the surface in the eastern tropical Pacific. And if you look at the blue line below that, the surface there, that's the thermocline, which is an oceanographer's word for the boundary between warm surface waters and the cold waters below. And the thermocline gets brought up in the east and down in the west. During El Nino, those trade winds relax. And that means, as we saw, the eastward surface currents spread that warm water eastward over the surface. The cold water gets buried beneath as the thermocline tilts upward in the west and downward in the east. And if you look on the right-hand panel of slide 11, you can see that this is actually reflected in global ocean temperature anomalies. So these show global temperature anomalies from the surface down to 2,000 decibars, which is essentially 2,000 meters, from 2004 to the end of 2015. And I've circled a couple of years. There's an La Nina early in the record around 2008, 2009. And you can see that the La Nina, actually this cold water brought up in the Pacific, actually cools surface temperatures on average around the planet. And the little warm dot, contours there, the red ones, show that the heat was actually sequestered below the surface in the ocean during La Nina. During El Nino, you have the opposite thing. You cool the subsurface waters and you warm the surface waters. And that has an impact on global surface temperatures. On top of this, if we look at the right-hand panel here, there's a decadal warming trend, of course, of as high as 0.15 degrees C per decade over this particular time period. All right, if we go to slide 12, you can see the sea surface temperature effects of El Nino. So these are sea surface temperatures for 2015 relative to a long-term average. And you can see these very warm sea surface temperatures along the tropical eastern equatorial Pacific, and that's the El Nino signature. We also had in 2015 very warm sea surface temperatures off the Pacific Northwest, and that's the blob, which persisted through much of 2015. And there is a sidebar in the report that talks about one of the possible consequences of that blob, which is a very widespread harmful algal bloom that might be of interest. Impacts on sea life, marine mammals, fisheries, birds, etc. If we go to the next slide, I'm going to go back to the global. So on slide 13, on the upper left panel, this is a pattern called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and it's what the sea surface temperature anomalies look like for a typical warm phase or a positive phase of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. You get warm water in the eastern equatorial Pacific, warm water off the west coast of North America, and cool water in the Pacific. And if you look at the bottom slide, this is the PDO index, which from 1970 through the end of 2015. And you can see that from 1998 through about 2013, we were in a cold phase, more or less in a cold phase of El Nino. This is a time when the Earth perhaps warmed a little less quickly than the long-term average. We've now entered a warm phase, though, and that has global impacts. So if we go to slide 14, we can look at those global impacts. What we see are record high sea surface temperature in the upper panel there. This is sea surface temperatures, global sea surface temperature anomalies from a long-term average from four different analyses, and they are all record high. They were record high by between 0.08 and 0.11 degrees C, depending on which analysis you do. That's the increase between 2014 and 2015. 2014 was already record high in most of those analyses as well. If we look at the lower left panel on slide 14, we see the global sea level, global mean sea level anomalies. And this is from 1993 to 2016, when we have had very precise satellites up measuring the sea surface around the globe every 10 days. And you can see a trend of about 3.3 millimeters per year. And part of that is because as seawater warms up, it expands, and so sea level rises. And as part of that is because on a melting planet, we're melting ice on land, and that that land water, that water from the ice runs into the ocean and also raises sea level. So going back to this warming ocean, in the lower right panel, we can see global average 0 to 700 meter ocean heat content. This is upper ocean heat content. There are five different analyses, and all of them show, again, that 2015 was a record high year. The y-axis on this is heat content in zettajoules. That's a joule with 10 to the 21st, sorry, a joule with 21 zeros after it. So it's this is a huge amount of heat. And in fact, over the last, from 1993 through 2015, the ocean heat content in the upper, just in the upper 700 meters rose by, on average, a trend among these five analyses of 130 zettajoules, which is a massive number. And now I'll pass the baton over to Jackie.
Thanks, Greg. Well, it really should come as no surprise that changes we're observing in global and regional temperatures are affecting the reliant ecosystem. One really good example that is presented in a sidebar of the report is the observed change in fish populations in the Arctic's Barents Sea. You can see that on slide 15 here in the graphic that's presented. Boreal or warm affinity species are moving north and displacing Arctic or cold water affinity species. You can see this, the warmer Atlantic fishes are represented in the red, and the Arctic species are in the purple. You can see on 2004 on the left compared to 2012 on the right, think the red is getting bigger and the purple is getting smaller. Now, most of the fish species moving into the northern Barents Sea tend to be generalist. In other words, they can use a wide range of habitats and feed on a diverse set of prey. They're very adaptable versus the Arctic species that are considered specialist. So they can't adapt very well to change. The shift that we're seeing is likely related to improved habitat conditions for boreal species. That includes both warmer water and greater food availability, which is now present in the northern Barents Sea, where we see that ocean temperatures have increased in association with an earlier and more extensive loss of the sea ice cover during the summer melt season. We observed that late summer temperature at the seafloor of the Barents Sea has increased by almost 1 degree centigrade during the last decade. Sea surface temperature in the region has also been on the rise. In August 2015, sea surface temperature in the Barents Sea was up to 8 degrees centigrade above average. We saw similarly high sea surface temperatures observed in the Chukchi and Kara Seas in late summer 2015. Again, this relatively high temperature was related to the pace and extent of sea ice loss. Going on to slide 16 now, the increased rate and extent of summer sea ice loss in regions of the Arctic Ocean are related to a persistent increase in surface air temperatures. As we can see from the blue line here, or the blue chart, since the beginning of the 20th century, Arctic-wide annual average surface air temperature over land north of 60 degrees north has increased 2.8 degrees centigrade. In 2015, the Arctic-wide annual average surface air temperature over this region was 1.2 degrees above the 1981 to 2010 baseline average. This level of increase ties the recent years of 2007 and 2011 for the highest value in the observational record, which began in 1900. As you can see by comparing the blue and the red lines, currently the Arctic is warming at more than twice the rate of lower latitudes. This phenomenon is known as Arctic amplification. One of the primary mechanisms driving the relatively high rate of temperature increases in the Arctic is the reduction of surface albedo, or surface reflectivity, during the summer months. This is related to the more extensive loss of sea ice, snow cover, and land ice in the Arctic regions. Basically, when these white surfaces melt away, they're replaced by darker surfaces that absorb rather than reflect sunlight, and hence further increase surface temperatures and accelerate melting. As you can see from slide 17, the Arctic sea ice cover is clearly affected by this persistent warming trend in surface air temperatures. In February 2015, the lowest ever maximum ice extent in satellite record, which begins in 1979 and is represented by the blue line in the left-hand graphic, occurred on the 25th of February. This was 15 days earlier than average. In February and March, the oldest ice, which is defined as being greater than 4 years old, made up 3% of the ice cover, while new first-year ice made up 70% of the ice pack. 30 years ago, as you can see in the graphic on the right, in 1985, the composition of the ice cover was much different. 20% of the pack was over 4 years old, and only 50% was classified as first-year ice. In September 2015, the minimum sea ice extent, which is represented by the red line on the left-hand graphic, was the fourth lowest value in the satellite record. It's worth noting that the nine lowest minimum extents, again, the red line and the left-hand graphic, have occurred in the last 9 years. These observations confirm a trend towards a thinner and more vulnerable Arctic sea ice cover. Turning to slide 18, the Greenland ice sheet also experienced extensive melting again in 2015. Melting occurred over more than 50% of the ice sheet for the first time since the exceptional summer of 2012, when melting occurred over 90% of the ice sheet. Melt season duration in 2015 was as much as 30 to 40 days longer than average in western, northwestern, and northeastern Greenland. Those are the areas represented by red in the left-hand graphic. It was close to or below average elsewhere on the ice sheet. This unusual melt duration pattern, with more melting in the north than the south, is consistent with anomalous jet stream behavior that caused persistent clear sky conditions that enhanced melting in northern Greenland and cold northerly airflow that inhibited melting in southern Greenland. On slide 19, we can see that the loss of ice on land isn't limited to the Greenland ice sheet. We also observe clear downward trends in the cumulative mass balance of glaciers in all regions of the Arctic. Preliminary data from land-based monitoring stations and satellite-based instruments indicate that 2015 will be the 36th consecutive year of glacier ice loss. Regional variability and permafrost temperature records indicate that since 2000, more substantial permafrost warming has taken place in higher latitudes compared to the subarctic. This pattern is also in agreement with the pattern of average air temperature anomalies. In other words, the anomalies, there's more, the anomalies are warmer in the north compared to the southern regions of the Arctic. In 2015, as you can see on the right-hand graphic, record high temperatures at 20-meter depths in the permafrost monitoring stations were measured at all permafrost observatories on the north slope of Alaska. Permafrost warming in that we see in Alaska and is shown in this graphic really exemplifies what's happening to permafrost on a pan-Arctic scale. In general, the Arctic provides a really good illustration of the impacts of the persistent warming trend in surface temperatures, which now extends over 30 years in the Arctic region. It shows the strong connectivity that occurs between various physical elements of the global system, and it also illustrates the impact of change on the reliant ecosystems. Brady, back to you.
Thank you very much, Jackie and the other speakers. We'll now take specific questions from the call participants. Again, if you, once announced by the operator, please indicate who you'd like to answer the question if possible. And operator, can you remind the participants how they can ask a question and queue up the first call? Thanks.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name slowly and clearly. And to withdraw your request, you may press star 2. Again, that's star 1 and record your name. Our first question comes from Seth Bornstein, and please state your company name.
I'm with the Associated Press. Thanks for doing this, Tom. I guess this is for you. In the past, you've called this the annual physical. You do so in the press release, or it's the annual physical. So if that's the case, how bad is this fever, the rising fever that Greg writes in his haiku? What would its equivalent be if it were a human? And how? And what would you say if you were the doctor to the Earth here, the prognosis is compared to how much we've changed from last year? And do we really have to, you know, as someone who avoids doctors sometimes, since it's going to get better when now that the El Niño's disappeared, why should we worry?
Thanks, Seth. Appreciate that question. I'll also let my colleagues add in to whatever I say if they care to. I think clearly the report in 2015 shows not only that the temperature of the planet is increasing, but all the related symptoms that you might expect to see with a rising temperature are also occurring. And if you can make all kinds of analogies to the human body, but the key is it's in all of the so-called essential climate variables we see, from sea ice to glaciers. You saw the permafrost, subsurface ocean temperatures, sea level. You can look at various aspects of temperature, you know, how many warm days, as Jessica showed. But clearly, it's more than temperature. It's reflected in the elements of what constitutes the climate. And as we mentioned earlier, we're beginning to see it in ecosystems. So the impacts are beyond the physical now and are entering the realms of the biophysical.
And why will it get better now that El Niño is gone?
Well, El Niño certainly gave it a boost, so to speak, from the standpoint of global temperatures. And we know this to be true. We see it in models. We've seen it in the observations in the past. But it's rather interesting that we are actually imposing El Niños upon an elevated state. And so despite the fact that the El Niño has now decayed, as you probably heard from last month, you know, we still are breaking all-time global temperature records. So though temperatures won't be as extreme as some of the individual months in the next year or so, that's unlikely. However, they will still be very highly elevated. It's very likely that this year will be a record. And depending on just how strong a La Nina develops, we may see continued records every other year as the trends continue to increase.
Thank you.
And this is Jessica. I'll just chime in for a minute on that question. When you talk about the El Niños and it enhanced the global temperature, which in turn enhanced a lot of the other records setting for the indicators that we saw this year. But every time we have a strong El Niño now, it's stronger. The temperature is higher than the previous one. So the global temperature was higher than in 1998 when we had the last strong El Niño. Sea ice has a lower extent in 2015 than it did in 1998. Glaciers are melting faster in 2015 than they were in 1998. So just because the El Niño has ended does not mean that we're going to go back to where we were before. We're going to continue to climb. And some of the impacts that we're seeing from the El Niño, like these really intense droughts and effects on the ecosystem, these can have long-lasting impacts that last well, can be permanent even, or last for several years or decades.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Emily Gertz, and please state your company name.
Participant Media. Thanks for taking the time to do this call. One thing I noticed was that in the report you noted that sea surface temperatures in some parts of the North Atlantic actually dropped from where they were in 2014, which I think was already a record cold. What are you attributing that to?
So this is Greg Johnson. I guess I will field that. There were sea surface temperatures in the North Atlantic were quite cold in 2015, as they were in 2014 as well. And that is partly because the winter weather over the North Atlantic was fairly stormy over those 2 years. And so that actually removed a lot of heat from the ocean and cooled it down. At the same time, there has been a decrease in the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. And this reduction in sea surface temperatures in the North Atlantic in some climate models is consistent with that reduction in the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. So this is actually an area of study, and I think I'll just leave it at that. So those two things could be linked, but people are still working on that, and I think the jury is out.
Does that conclude the question or comment?
I guess I wondered what are the factors you're studying to, try to explain this? I mean, are you looking at increased freshwater from the Greenland ice cap, for instance?
That's certainly something that scientists are including in their models, and so increased freshwater from ice melting is a possibility that can increase the stratification of the upper ocean and make it more difficult to form the deep water that drives the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And again, as a reminder at this time, if you have a question or a comment, it is *1. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name. And to withdraw that request, you may press *2. Again, for questions or comments, press *1. Our next question or comment comes from Andrea Thompson, and please state your company name.
Hi, yes, it's Climate Central. You guys noted these several records that were set last year and that some of them broke records set just in 2014, and now we have 2016, has broken some records, poised to break others. So I guess what can we kind of glean from that, and what of the records do you think 2016 is likely to break?
Hi, Andrea. This is Jessica Blunden. Generally, after you have an El Nino emerge in 1 year and then decline in the next year, you can continue to set records, which we have been seeing. For one, a big one, the global surface temperature has remained elevated through the first half of 2016. By the end of June, it was more than 1 degree Celsius higher than the 20th century average, and it's about 0.2 degrees Celsius higher than it was in 2015. So it's quite possible that 2016 will set a new global temperature record. There may be other records set as well as the heat has started to decline. We have to wait and see what happens. We don't know what's going to happen with the La Nina situation, if it's going to continue to evolve and if it will be weak or strong. We just have to wait and see.
Do you know if the year-over-year CO2 increase was larger this year than last year?
For the year to date, for the first half of the year?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is a little more. I think it's 0.06 degrees higher this year than it was last year with respect to the difference.
Thanks.
Yeah, this is Tom Carl. One comment I could make with respect to what we're seeing is this change in baseline state, which really presents some interesting issues for climatologists in terms of trying to understand what it means for us and how do we actually label things. So, for example, we know El Nino and La Nina, you heard Greg describe how it affects the wind patterns, and basically it is been identified in terms of strength by climatologists looking at sea surface temperatures as one measure and how elevated they are in certain portions of the Pacific. Well, what's happening as overall global temperatures are increasing, those numbers don't go down as low as they used to. And so when we classify conditions where sea surface temperature is our important contribution, then that suggests what might have been a stronger La Nina based on sea surface temperatures or its contribution, it doesn't look as strong anymore, and the El Ninos look stronger. But in reality, what's really important are the gradients. So we're going to have to look at that. That's some evolving science that needs to take place given this changing base state that we're seeing so we can better describe and understand the intensity of these events that are so important in terms of driving these regional changes as well.
Does that conclude the question or comment?
Yes.
Thank you. Our next question or comment is from Eric Roston, and please state your company name.
Hi, it's Eric Roston from Bloomberg. Thanks very much. Two questions. One is, could you talk a little bit more about the change in the Pacific Decadal Oscillation and what the influence that may have over the next 5 or 10 years on global temperature averages. The second question is, in terms of climate monitoring infrastructure, satellite, sea, whatever it is, what do you wish you had that you don't have? Thanks.
So I guess this is Greg Johnson. I'll speak to the Pacific Decadal Oscillation question. So as I noted in the presentation, from 1998 through about 2013, we were in a cool phase of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And during that time period, we did see a global average temperature rise. It was perhaps a little slower than the long-term average. And we've now shifted into a warm phase since the beginning of 2014, roughly. We can't project or predict what the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is going to do over the next 5 to 10 years. It is a it's possible if it stays in a warm phase, then we may see global average surface temperatures rise a little faster than the average rate than they would have otherwise been expected to rise just based on greenhouse gas concentrations. But we can't predict that, I think.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Dee Garnt responding to your question about monitoring. We've been geeking out a little bit talking about it, but you know, we in general, for any scientist, in order to paint a clearer picture of what's going on in the world, kind of more observations and more precise observations and more reliable observations are better. With climate, one important thing that we do is we are connected both to our past and our future. And so as we go forward, you know, one of the magic kind of special things that we do in climate monitoring is we're using observations taken by people that are long since dead, that were taken by hand in pen and pencil and paper, and comparing those to observations that are taken thousands of miles in space, and trying to help understand where we've been, where we are, and where we're going in terms of climate. And I think if our approach to our observation platforms honors both of those aspects, both the space-age futuristic observations, but also protecting these traditional types of observations that have been going on for generations, we'll have a much healthier picture of the climate system and a much more confident understanding of what's going on in the world around us.
This is Jackie. I just want to emphasize the point that you just made. I think that one of the concerns that we see, particularly in the Arctic region, is a loss of land and ice-based measurements to help us interpret the satellite. It's somewhat paradoxical, and that in this massively changing environment, we actually see a reduction in the number of some of the land-based measurements that are being taken. And without those, you know, progress will not be as good as it could be. So I would really stress the need to continue the land base to complement the satellite.
Yeah, this is Tom. Just to pile on to what my colleagues have said, one of the key measurement elements are how much heat's going into the oceans, and we've been fortunate to have an international array of floats that probe autonomously deep into the ocean. And what we need to focus on is be able to get those probes to go to the depths of the ocean. Right now, we're pretty good down to you know, several hundred meters, but getting them regularly go down to the depths would be really, really important. Another area that is also important, we do have satellites now measuring the very top skin soil moisture, but we all know that it's really important to understand what the soil moisture content's doing down to a meter or so, in some places 2 meters. And so having a global monitoring system for soil moisture and its connectivity to all the ecosystem aspects that are required to understand how it affects vegetation, extremely important. And last but not least, our ability to measure elements like ocean circulation. Greg mentioned the meridional overturning circulation is really critical for us understanding the regional impacts of climate. That requires a significant effort of measurements in the oceans, and that's something that we would hope would grow and be enhanced over the years.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. And again, as a reminder, for further questions or comments, please press star 1 at this time. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name. And to withdraw that request, you may press star 2. Once again, for further questions or comments at this time, press star 1. One moment while we stand by for questions or comments. One moment, please. And we do have one question that queued up from Hunter Cutting. And please state your company name.
Hey there, it's Hunter from Climate Signals. Thanks for doing the call, really appreciate it. I had a question. I was just kind of curious about some of the emphasis you guys are giving to different pieces of the picture here. And in particular, I noted that in the 2014 report, in some of the highlights that you published online, you emphasized the land surface temperature and the ocean temperature and the changes in those. But in the highlights of the global temperature for this report, you don't include the oceans. Rather, you include the troposphere temperature, which, of course, has had a different trend over the last decade. And I'm just wondering why that change in emphasis.
Hi, this is Jessica. Thanks for the question. Actually, we have a lot of variables in the State of the Climate report, and a lot of them are important, and there's only so much information that you can put into a press summary. And so we just focus on what we feel is the most important for the year, not really choosing one over the other one, but simply a matter of space. So it's not that we don't care about the ocean surface temperature or the land surface temperature compared to the temperature in the upper atmosphere. It's just the space that we have. But we never stop monitoring any of these, and they're always in the reports.
Well, I mean, if I could follow up, so what was it about troposphere temperature that you wanted to emphasize it in the highlights of this report?
I think in a year when the surface – this is Deke Arndt, thank you. In a year when the surface temperature was so extraordinarily above what we've seen in recorded history, or at least the modern history of observing, it was appropriate to kind of – to take a look at different parts of the atmosphere as well. Kind of verify and provide context to the very warm temperatures that we've seen down here at the surface. The troposphere is an important piece of the equation. It's where all of our weather happens, and it is one of the variables that we track continuously, both here at NCEI and in many institutions around the world.
Hunter, this is Tom Carl. I may just add some additional information that might help you. I mean, I know you mentioned the land surface air temperature and the ocean temperature and the troposphere temperature. One thing to recall is, particularly during El Niños, the response in the troposphere is heavily influenced by the late heat of condensation as there's more precipitation during El Niño years. And there's a delay for that to manifest itself. And it was quite apparent, again, if you look at 2016 and the troposphere is substantially warmer than it was in 2015. And so you have to recognize there is a bit of a little different physics going on in those two layers of the atmosphere.
Well, I was kind of curious about that because in what looks like kind of hard to tell from the graph, I'm not sure if it's the end of El Nino, but it looks like of the 98-99 El Nino, tropospheric warming was much greater. But in the current El Nino, it's the reverse.
Yeah, and you have to pay attention to what data set. So this State of the Climate report was for 2015. It was based on the tropospheric data sets we had. Some of them have been reanalyzed. And if you update it through 2016, you'll see 2016 far exceeds what the 1998 El Nino had, even for the troposphere.
Got you. That's a very helpful add-on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And our next question or comment comes from Emily Gertz, and please state your company name.
Hi, Participant Media. This question is for Jackie. You were describing the changes in the Arctic, including melting permafrost and lack, decreasing sea ice in sort of record-keeping terms. I wondered if there are any community impacts that stand out for you in the past year,
like places where people are losing their livelihoods or being forced to relocate or just, you know, grappling with maintaining infrastructure as the permafrost melts. Are there any particular standouts?
Nothing in particular as far as a specific example, but to say that in general, because we see this persistent warming, there is a lot of work going on to understand how to take infrastructure systems that were installed with the assumption that permafrost would always be permanent and how to adapt them to the changing environment, the environment that's already changing, and the projections of how changes are going to move forward. And certainly, I think the Arctic has issues with regard to the land. There's also the deep concern with regard to increased activity in the marine environment. With the persistent loss of sea ice in the summertime, there's a significant increase in activity with regard to shipping, increased danger, frankly, for subsistence hunters in going out, for instance, hunting whale with the instability of the ice cover. So you see the community in all ways looking at a change in the environment and how they're adapting to it, from top to bottom.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And our final question comes from Seth Borenstein. And please state your company name.
The Associated Press. Good. Well, I bookend this then. Just to go back to a couple questions ago, Tom, or Jessica or Deke, if you want to jump in here. Just can you give me the data on how much warmer this El Nino has been than last year? Is it like 0.7 degrees or something like that? I mean, do you have the data on how much warmer it has been during El Nino 15-16 compared to El Nino 97-98?
Hey, Seth, this is Deke. Are you talking about for the El Nino region itself, or are you talking about global temperatures compared?
Global temperatures.
It depends on the data set. I'll have to get back with you. We can get with you to get those specifics. The difference, to make sure we understand, you're talking about the difference in global temperature between the 15-16 event and the 97-98 event.
Right. In other words, show that it's not just El Nino, but since, you know, if it were those, it's fair to say those two are almost equivalent El Ninos, or at least that's what Mike Halpert keeps saying.
Sure.
Thus, if there were no underlying effects, wouldn't the temperatures be about the same, but yet there is a larger change, obviously.
Sure. So this is basically putting the numbers on Tom's point about the changing baseline. And
right, exactly. I'm just looking for those numbers.
Yeah, and Seth, I'm not looking at the numbers, but I can tell you if you line up all the El Nino events and take away, look at global temperatures and pick out all the El Nino events and line them up and try to fit a trend to them and compare that to the global trend, they're about the same. So, you know, what's going on with all the events is just kind of elevating all the temperatures, but they can give you the exact numbers.
Because in 2012, you guys did a wonderful graphic, you know, blue for, I don't know which one was blue and which one was red, where you color-coded El Niños and La Niñas and gray was neutral. I do remember that part. And then you showed the lines of all three areas on one graph. But that I don't think I've seen an update on that since 2012, and it'd be great to get a visual update of that. So.
Thanks, Seth. We'll get on that. We have some very similar graphics that we've used as a companion to some of the recent monthly reports, and I'll point you towards those.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd now like to turn the call back over to Brady Phillips for closing remarks.
Okay. Thank you to all the speakers for participating in the call and to all the great questions we received. If you do have further questions, please feel free to contact me at brady.phillips@noaa.gov. That's brady.phillips, or my colleague John Leslie, and that's john.leslie@noaa.gov. As a reminder, a press release with the links can be found by linking from our NOAA.gov website or if you go to the NCEI website. And there are, don't forget to check out the supplemental visualizations at climate.gov. And I'll end with a couple of reminders for some upcoming climate and weather-related updates. So on August 8th, NOAA NCI will release the U.S. climate highlights for the month of July at 11 a.m. On August 11th, NOAA will provide an Atlantic hurricane seasonal outlook update. On August 17th, the global climate highlights for July will be released. And on August 18th, we'll have our next monthly climate call. So thank you for your time today, and have a good day. Thank you.
That concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.